What this is an old-fashioned calendar that continues to change when the emperor changes.
It's a new era for Japan. It's Tuesday, April 2nd. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us. Find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, blowback against Brunei brutality. Australia's social media is on notice. Philippines fights foul air, transplanting with HIV, and thin technology thick with possibilities. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Japan declared on Monday the name of its new imperial era when Crown Prince Naruhito becomes emperor May 1st, with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe saying it emphasized traditional values at a turning point in the nation's history. Crowds watching giant television screens across Tokyo roared and raised their phones to take photos as a somber chief cabinet secretary held up a white placard with the new name, Reiwa, written in two characters in black ink. VOA Asia's Ira Melman got in touch with Carol Gluck, professor of Japanese history at New York's Columbia University, to ask her what this is all about.
This is an unusual calendar process by which the Japanese have for centuries and centuries given a period of time what they call an imperial reign name. And in earlier times, it just meant that, well, there had been a flood, and so they changed it to change. They changed the reign name, or there had been a change of this or that and the other. So that they've changed quite often for reasons of you know, as I said, catastrophe or good news. But in the modern period, which begins in Japan in 1868, they decided they have a modern monarch, a modern emperor, and each modern emperor would have one reign name. It would be that name from the time he ascended the throne till the time he died. So Japanese all think of the calendar, less so than they used to because they now use Western calendar so much. They think of it as the X year of that reign name. This is the last year, year 31 of the Heisei era, Heisei 31. So what this is an old-fashioned calendar that continues to change when the emperor changes.
Is Japan the only major country to use this? I read that it started in China. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, it started in China. Oh, there are lots of older societies that had what we would call, not reign names, but period names. So is Japan the only one now? I can't answer that, but it is unusual, I think. That much you can say. But it's a common thing in the past, true.
How widely is it used?
Less than it used to be. It used to be, for example, when it started, which was 1868, everybody used it all the time for everything. Now, about 49.5% Japanese people use both the Western calendar, 2019, and the reign name calendar. It is, however, regarded as convenient by many Japanese, this particular way of noting the calendar. So the convenience is more the reason than anything else. Nobody really knows or cares too much about the next question you're going to ask me, which is, what does this mean?
Yes, what does this mean? How did you know?
How did I know? The reign names are chosen with a very complicated bureaucratic process, partly because they were originally and are still connected to the imperial institution, which means they're quite ritualized and ceremonial, so making the decision is hard. They comb usually the Chinese classics and find two Chinese characters which are auspicious, and they put them together. It's a kind of aspirational name. They're always positive. And this one means something like auspicious harmony. The last one meant peaceful reign. I mean, you see what I'm saying? These are all they are combinations of two characters, not one word, two characters usually, that have a good positive meaning. But basically they're looking for a vague but positive set of two characters.
There seem to be, from news reports I have seen, huge interest in this in Japan. Is there indeed?
Yes, it's a bit of a sport, actually. People were betting on whether there would be a a hey in there, you know, a peace, or the wa, which also means peaceful. The new T-shirts today, everybody says rewa. It's present enough in your life. For example, if you have stationery, you're going to have to change it, which, of course, makes some business for people. And the stamps are going to have to change, the date stamps and things of that sort. So it's a spectator sport more than anything else. And they were all, you know, waiting at the newsstands this morning to see what the announcement was going to be.
There are reports that Microsoft came out with some concern that this might be like a Y2K moment for the computers in Japan. Have you heard that?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. It might be true. But I do think that the change of reign name, which we had in 1989 to Heisei, is not like the Y2K thing precisely because the calendar noting, it doesn't work the same way. In the West, all four digits changed, and so many of things had been based on the first two digits being 1-9. There's none of that here. In fact, they even avoided the semblance of that by saying we're not going to even choose the first letter being the same.
What about the change now? This apparently is the first one that is not built so much on the China history, but more on the Japanese history.
Well, yes, this is the first time that they've chosen two characters not from a classical Chinese text, but from the first collection anthology of Japanese poetry. So, yes, that's a change. On the other hand, where they took it from in this particular, because it's so early, it's 8th century, is actually written in Chinese. But it's not China. It's not Chinese. I mean, the language may be. But it's a Japanese text, and that is a departure. Now the next question that everyone wants to know is, does this signify a nationalistic move? For most people who don't care what this means or know, you know, pay much attention to it, it will not matter where it came from. I will quote the Prime Minister, who is a nationalist, but what he said was that comes from the section, and he's right, from the anthology, that says this is the plum blossoms coming up, blooming after the severe winter. Now, basically, that's saying we've had a hard time in Japan for the last, and we're now getting out of our severe winter, and we will have the blossoms of spring.
Ira Melman speaking with Carol Gluck, professor of Japanese history at Columbia University. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com online. Philippine police kill 14 men rights groups say were farmers. Murder charge reduced for Kim Killer. Thais protest cheating election commission. How the public can visit the disputed, undeveloped South China Sea. Japan prepares to usher in a new era. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories with lots of photos and videos and much more on Facebook and VOA Asia, as well as the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is urging the government of Brunei to stop its revised penal code from entering into force Wednesday. Bachelet says the application of the death penalty under the new law, which she calls cruel and inhumane, violates international human rights law. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the High Commissioner's headquarters in Geneva.
Brunei's tourist brochures describe the country as a haven of tranquility. That may once have been the case, as Brunei, a Muslim monarchy, has not executed anyone since 1957. But its recent decision to impose the death penalty, including death by stoning, is stirring international outrage. Under the revised penal code, people would be executed for offenses such as rape, adultery, homosexual relations, robbery, and insult to the Prophet Muhammad. Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet warns the new code, if implemented, would mark a serious setback for human rights protections in Brunei. Her spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, tells VOA, "It is very easy to fall afoul of this law because it is so broad."
For example, it criminalizes exposing Muslim children to the beliefs and practices of any religion other than Islam. It also introduces public flogging as a punishment for abortion, for example, which again would disproportionately affect people who are already vulnerable. It would disproportionately affect women.
Shamdasani says there's no contradiction between human rights and faith. They are not opposing forces. She says her office has worked with religious leaders from all over the world to draft the so-called Beirut Declaration on Faith for Rights.
And this is a very constructive document, which again helps countries that, you know, are motivated by the desire to integrate religious tenets into their law to do so while fully respecting international human rights obligations so that they can work jointly to uphold human dignity and equality for all.
International law allows for the imposition of the death penalty only for the crime of murder or international killing. Bachelet says any religion-based legislation must not violate human rights. She says her office is ready to work with the Brunei government to bring it into compliance with its international human rights obligations. Sultan Hassanai Bolkiah rules the oil-rich monarchy and is one of the world's wealthiest people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, China says it is adding an all fentanyl-related compounds to its list of controlled substances beginning May 1st. U.S. officials have long campaigned for the move. Fentanyl and compounds that mimic its effects are blamed for tens of thousands of opioid overdose deaths in the United States each year. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Australia is planning to become the first country in the world to impose jail terms and multi-million dollar fines for social media giants that do not quickly remove violent material. The changes are in response to the live streaming of some of the Christchurch mosque shootings, and a bill will be introduced to the Australian Parliament this week. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Christchurch atrocity was streamed by the gunman live on Facebook for 17 minutes. It remained online for more than an hour after the attack, in which 50 worshippers were murdered at two mosques in the New Zealand city. Australia's Attorney General Christian Porter says the social media giant was too slow to remove the shocking video.
At close to 60 minutes, the New Zealand police requested that they take it down, and that didn't happen until around the 69-minute mark. So what we would say, and I think what any rational person would say, is that that is a totally unreasonable period of time.
The alleged perpetrator is a 28-year-old self-confessed white supremacist from Australia. Australian government ministers met officials from social media companies to discuss the swift removal of offensive content last week, but lawmakers weren't satisfied. Australia now wants to impose multi-billion dollar fines on companies that don't act quickly to take down abhorrent violent material. Executives could go to prison for 3 years. But cybersecurity expert Nigel Fair from the University of New South Wales thinks the proposed legislation goes too far.
I'm a believer that jail time is for serious and violent offenders and not for the marketing executive of a social media company. I think we need to continue the discussion. Fines is a good thing. I'm sure we can get to a balanced way of dealing with this issue.
Facebook says it removed 1.5 million copies of the Christchurch video in the days following the attack. The social media giant has also said it's taking steps to strengthen rules for live streaming and to combat the spread of hate online. Australia's Parliament will consider the new laws this week. The role of social media in the Christchurch massacre will also be scrutinised by a powerful commission of inquiry to be set up by the New Zealand government. The alleged gunman is expected to appear in court on Friday. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, the Jedi faithful battle CO2 in the Philippines. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, British rock superstar Elton John is joining actor George Clooney in calling for a worldwide boycott of hotels owned by the Sultan of Brunei, who plans to enforce the death penalty for homosexuality this week. Brunei, a Muslim monarchy, has adopted Sharia law that allows for people to be stoned to death. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, 12 years after the inaugural Earth Hour observance in Australia, countries around the world continue joining the grassroots gesture against man-made carbon dioxide emissions. This year in the Philippines, fans of the movie Star Wars, armed with lightsabers, joined the world with a nod to a galaxy far, far away. Arash Arabasadi uses the Force to tell us more.
These Star Wars fans are not trying out for a role in the franchise's next film. They are, however, observing the annual Earth Hour initiative.
So when the lights come down, our sabers come up, and that's our way to rally. That's our rally together. You know, people can do great things when they come together.
The Earth Hour observance started more than a decade ago in Australia. The World Wildlife Fund organized the grassroots movement against man-made CO2 emissions linked to warming the planet.
Even in face of all these environmental problems, we can come together as one group under one banner, one lightsaber, you know, everyone common, and, you know, we can really make a change.
Saturday, about 100 Star Warriors marched through the Philippine capital, Manila. Fans of all ages raised the famous lightsaber in the mostly blacked-out commercial district.
I think using Star Wars as a touch point for a lot of people gives the message that there are ways to go about this. There are ways to have fun in the dark that, you know, promote that message that you can conserve energy and you can have fun while doing it.
The Philippine Islands were just one of many places taking part. According to Earth Hour, more than 180 countries and territories joined this year's observance. At 8:30 p.m. local time Saturday, major capitals around the world turned off their lights. But as the name implies, they were back on by about 9:30. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
This news from VOA Asia, a Vietnamese woman is now the only suspect remaining in the detention in Malaysia for the killing of half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. She pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of causing hurt by dangerous weapons or means. Murder charges stemming from the same incident were dropped last month against an Indonesian woman. More on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, for the first time, a person living with HIV has donated a kidney to a transplant recipient also living with HIV. VOA's Carol Pearson reports a team from Johns Hopkins Medicine in Baltimore performed the surgery March 25th.
Up until now, people with HIV were not permitted to donate their organs, even to others living with HIV. The surgery was considered too risky for the potential donor, but treatment for HIV has changed so much since the disease was first detected in the 1980s that two doctors at Johns Hopkins Medicine in Baltimore decided it was time to explore that possibility. In the first ever HIV to HIV kidney transplant, Dr. Dori Segev, the surgeon, spoke to VOA by Skype. Segev said the procedure was more than a kidney transplant.
This week, we celebrate the first time that somebody living with HIV became a living kidney donor, was able to donate a kidney to somebody else to save somebody else's life. And it's sort of a celebration that HIV has transitioned from a disease that 30 years ago was basically a death sentence to today, a condition that is so well controlled with modern medication that somebody with HIV can actually save somebody else's life by donating a kidney.
People with well-controlled HIV can live a healthy life and have a normal lifespan. Dr. Dori Segev fully evaluated the donor before allowing her to undergo the procedure.
Nina Martinez, who was the person who donated the kidney, is exceptionally healthy with meticulous care of her HIV and completely well-controlled HIV and no risk of heart disease, lung disease, kidney disease, the kind of things that would rule somebody out from donating. The recipient is somebody with HIV who has end-stage kidney disease and needs a transplant.
The surgery took place on March 25th. Segev says the donor and the recipient are doing well. Segev says what's most important is that this surgery increases the number of potential kidney donors and the number of people whose lives can be saved.
Nina's groundbreaking donation and interest in becoming the first living kidney donor with HIV in the entire world now opens a door for everybody to do this.
Right now, it's only legal to do HIV to HIV transplantation. But Dr. Christina Durand, who works with Segev, says one day people living with HIV might be able to donate organs to those without the disease. Durand also spoke by Skype.
If I needed an organ transplant and there was a potential HIV-positive donor and it meant I needed to take an HIV medication for the rest of my life, I'd probably take that organ.
Both doctors say this surgery will help change the image of HIV and hopefully reduce the stigma associated with being positive. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
At just one atom thick, graphene is one of those miracle materials that many say is the stuff of the future. Now the future may be here as graphene's potential is being realized as the key to quick, efficient 5G networks and the future of telecommunications. Details of the story are much thicker as we hear from VOA's Kevin Enix.
This is the hexagonal lattice of carbon atoms called graphene. It's single atom thick, but stronger than steel. It conducts electricity and heat efficiently and has been slowly realizing its potential as a game changer. Kostya Novoselov, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on graphene, says one great application is in communications. Because graphene is completely transparent and can transmit information via optical circuits incredibly quickly and efficiently.
It just allows you to push the signal processing into the optical domains. And honestly, I don't think any other material, apart from graphene, can do the same, can change its optical state at the same pace. So I think that's probably one of the most exciting and at the same time realistic applications.
Lightweight graphene can be easily incorporated into everything from shoes to clothing to cars, and that will make them strong, flexible, and smart. And its ability to move information quickly is going to be part of what makes the super-fast 5G networks that are coming soon possible.
We started to see it first in composite material applications, in sport goods. Now it goes into advanced cars, but now we already start to see it being used for electronics, for printed electronics, and I think it just develops with a very good pace for a new material.
Graphene is also making more efficient solar panels possible, and it's making smart electronics smarter and faster. But graphene might even soon be making people better.
I think we will see more interesting applications, like applications in biotechnology, maybe in membrane technology. So those are quite exciting, but they need a little bit more time to mature.
Novoselov says graphene circuits are so sensitive, an atom-thin probe can read and map brain activity and send that information to doctors or a phone in case of medical emergency. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on the internet, iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as VOA Asia Facebook, and of course our website, voanews.com. You'll also find us on the radio throughout Asia, like the voice of Chungrung, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chungrung Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan. We thank everyone there who's tuned into our program today. And, of course, we thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Nelson Lopes, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.